thetomeshownetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again at noblenight.com. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
This is Eitan Bernstein, author of Dragons of Faerun and the Magic Item Compendium and Exemplars of Evil, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 127. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I've gathered a stalwart crew of brave and foolhardy adventurers for a trek into the depths of the Earth to face off against a horde of beholders, a city of drow, and one scheming aboleth, and the king that crawls, Torog, as we review the book, Underdark. With me today, let's start with Chris from the Icosahedrophilia blog and podcast. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you, Jeff. It's good to be here.
And we've also got a couple of folks that I think are new to the show. We've got Enrique from, who is in fact the newbie DM from Newbie DM the blog. Welcome, sir.
How's it going, Jeff? How are you, Jeff?
I am fantastic.
Thank you for inviting me on your show.
I've been looking for an opportunity to get you on. I know we talked a long time ago about getting you on to talk about Dungeon Delve, and that never quite solidified for us, so here we are now.
Well, here I am. I'm here, and I'm going to make sure you regret it.
Okay.
So there's no next time. Right.
We'll do it.
Just kidding. Listen, in all honesty, your podcast was the first D&D podcast I ever heard, so for me it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And although that's not too much of a feat, I think, other than the official D&D podcast, I might have been the first D&D podcast out there. So.
Well, I didn't say I enjoyed it. I said it was the first one I ever heard.
Yeah, exactly. I understand.
I'm just kidding.
good. And we've also got Mark with us. Mark from the RPG Circus podcast and the Dice Monkey blog. So welcome to the show.
How's it going?
To you as well.
Thanks a lot. I'm a big fan of the show. So
I've been looking for an opportunity to chat with you and interact a little bit with the RPG Circus these days anyway. I've been enjoying what you guys have to offer.
Thanks. Really appreciate it.
All right. So we've got one voice we know and a few we don't. It should be a pretty fun episode. I do have a couple of bits of news that I want to talk about before we go any further. First, one about me. I am scheduled to appear on another D&D podcast in the very near future. I'm recording this weekend for the Power Source podcast. They talk about some of the latest D&D news, give advice, answer questions. I've heard several of their episodes, and so far I like what I hear. Do be aware that it is between an hour and 2 hours long. So if you can't quite get enough of me and you want to hear me go in depth for a couple of hours with them, I should be on next week's episode of the Power Source podcast. Any of you guys listened to
Power
Source?
It's a great podcast.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm a really big fan of it.
I haven't heard.
It is a bit lengthy, though.
You just have to
grab a couple of
coffee. Power Source is one of those podcasts that I've, queued up and it hasn't quite come out the speakers yet.
Yeah. See, I've been doing that for a long time. It's one of those that I noticed and I started downloading and I have all the episodes and it's like, oh, he invited me to be on the show. I should listen to it and see if it's worth being on and it's a good show. So I'll be on this week or next week.
My last week, depending on when this releases. My iPod Touch got lost.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So my podcast listening has been very limited ever since I lost that iPod.
Sure.
So I haven't been able to check it out.
Well, and beyond.
But now that I know you're on, maybe I will.
Yeah, go check it out. In any case, beyond that, there's been lots of news coming out in the last several weeks because D&D Experience has happened since the last time I recorded, and they announced some of the rest of the product line for this year. I would say the highlights are some things we knew, like Dark Sun, Player's Handbook 3, Monster Manual 3. But there's also some new things they announced, like the Demonomicon, and I'm always a big fan of books full of demons. Board games, card games, a whole bunch of these new essentials lines to help new players get into the game, including a remake of the old Red Box for people who wanted that sense of nostalgia from way back before even my days. And you can probably expect that at least some of these things will be discussed here on the show in the next several months. So look forward to all those. Anything, hear anything from D&D Experience that they're excited about?
I'm really excited about the new board games.
Yeah, they have. We knew about the Ravenloft board game coming out, and now what was the new one they announced? Oh, I forget.
It's similar. It's the exact same rule set. Everything is just High Adventure. Yeah, Dragonfire Mountains.
Yeah, yeah, because it reminded me of the old Dragon Mountain box set of adventures that I used to have, or I probably still have somewhere. I wondered if it wasn't sort of tying into that. What'd you like?
I like the idea of taking the 4E rules as a tool set and creating another game out of it, like what they're doing with Gamma World,
yeah.
I think that'll show a little bit of the flexibility of the system.
Yeah, and I've never played Gamma World.
Aside from fantasy.
Yeah, definitely.
I'll be interested to see what Gamma World's all about, because I've never actually played it. I've heard all about it being in the community for so long, but I've never actually played a game.
I never played it either, so I'm excited about that.
I did notice, I found it interesting, they talked about Player's Handbook 3 and Monster Manual 3, but I didn't hear them say anything about DMG 3.
That's not on their list for 2010.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're focusing on the Essentials line to the exclusion of a DMG 3 in 2010. Or at least that's what it sounds like to me.
Well, I think maybe...
Which is disappointing, because... It's disappointing, because I've found the Dungeon Master's Guide's really, really useful, so...
I was going to say, I think, in my experience, DMG 2 is probably the best 4th edition book they've put out, and maybe they just didn't want to try to follow that up.
That's true.
Well, you know, theoretically, DMG 3 should, push on to focus, especially on epic tier adventures.
That's true.
Like that, as DMG 2 focused on the Paragon tier, but... You know, I suppose we could hope that that we might see it early in 2011 or something like that.
Who knows? Yeah, we'll see what happens. We'll keep our eyes open for that. But in any case, this episode we're talking about Underdark, a recently released book intended to give us what we as DMs need to make the ever dangerous Underdark into a setting that is useful and meaningful for our games. We're going to examine if they succeeded in that goal and see if the book Underdark makes us more likely to use that setting in our own games. But for now, before we get into that, I do want to take a moment to stop and talk about our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games. I'm going to use this ad as a chance to talk about another new book that came out from Wizards of the Coast recently called Dragonborn. It's a short paperback product for players, giving us things we need to make our Dragonborn character a little bit more awesome, with feats, powers, paragon paths, epic destinies, and all kinds of extra stuff. Have any of you guys read Dragonborn?
I did.
Yes,
Enrique
and I both have reviewed it. Yeah.
What'd you guys think?
And
I thought it was a fantastic book for what it was. I think for $9.99, I think it's a... First of all, two things. I think, one, that book should have been Wizards re-entry into the PDF market. I think that book would have made a perfect thing to sell on a PDF as sort of a testing ground for PDFs again. And two, I think for what it is, it's a great book for fluff purposes to counter the need, to counter that mentality of, I don't need a book, I have DDI. Why should I buy a book? I have, I'm a subscriber to DDI. I think this book gives you a reason why not to think like that, because it gives you a lot of fluff, it gives you a lot of backstory, it gives you a lot of flavor for the Dragonborn that you can't get on DDI.
Very cool.
That's what I liked about it. I think it's a good book.
Any other thoughts on Dragonborn?
No,
I'm really a big fan of the flavor text.
Now, one at a time. Chris, go.
No, I was just agreeing with Enrique. I mean, I think it's a good book. It's not as if it's devoid of crunch, so if you're not subscribing to DDI, you're still getting a lot of, really crunchy bits in a pretty short book. I was a little bit surprised. I mean, I guess I knew intellectually it was supposed to be 32 pages, but it feels a little wimpy, I guess, when you actually hold it in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really chock full of good stuff if you're going to play Dragonborn.
Yeah, it is. And Mark, you had a thought?
Oh, I was a really big fan of all the fluff to it. Probably about half the book felt like, I think, was about fluff to me. So I thought it was really nice, and I'm looking forward to seeing the rest of the different races, and I'm hoping that once they basically finish up all the races, they'll release all of them together in one big hardback book. I think that would be cool. Really nice to see.
Good. And as it was mentioned before, the book normally sells for $9.99, but right now you can get it at our sponsor NobleKnight.com for $8, making it even more affordable. You can check the show notes at thetomeshow.com for a link to this product from NobleKnight.com.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.nobleknight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
Okay, so it's time to talk about The Underdark. This book is broken up into 6 chapters, and we're going to kind of take a chapter-by-chapter approach, but we're also going to take a breakout to look at some things that are sort of consistent throughout the book. We're going to start off, though, by looking at our first chapter just as it is, because this first chapter is our introduction. It tells us what the Underdark is, how it was created. It gives us a lot of sort of the fluff that explains what is the Underdark and what makes it cool. Does that summarize what this first chapter is all about?
Yeah, I think so.
Yep.
It's sort of the DMG section of the Underdark, right? It's full of advice and campaign arcs and that kind of thing of this edition's concept of what the Underdark is.
You have to buy into the fourth edition backstory if you're going to take this book at face value, because the creation of the Underdark is directly tied into the concept of the, I think it's called the Dawn War with the gods and the primordials and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you're not subscribing to that, then you have to think of a different reason as to how the Underdark was created and why it is the way it is, you know, as far as this book is concerned. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I find that concept pretty easy for most settings to buy into, because that's sort of like, in the beginning, there was this war, you know, and it's pretty easy when something is that far removed from what the players are doing. I don't have much of a difficult time buying into that section. But there's another part of it that I do struggle a little bit with, because when they tell that story, they introduce the idea of this god Torog, who was partially responsible for creating the Underdark by thrashing around down in the tunnels and crashing through things and what have you. And that leaks its way into, I don't know, about 80-90% of the book. So if you don't buy into the fact that there's this god actually right now in the modern age crawling around down in those tunnels, then a lot of the fluff in the book just doesn't apply. You know, the fluff is good, but if you don't buy into that part, it just doesn't apply. If Torog isn't in your setting, then you've got some struggles.
I can see this book being a little bit less useful for people who are playing in Eberron and Forgotten Realms. But I think it's still, you know, basically if you ignore that stuff, then you're still good.
Mm-hmm. Chris?
Yeah, I guess I've always sort of associated the Underdark with the Forgotten Realms in previous editions.
Yeah.
So, you know, I pretty much set out second edition and didn't play, have never played in the Forgotten Realms at all. So this was all kind of new to me in some ways, and I don't know how much this mythology is consistent with earlier versions, or the earlier Forgotten Realms versions of Drow, for example, or why there is an Underdark at all. But I think there's probably a lot of creative things you could do with it if you don't want to use Torog. I haven't quite figured out what all of those are yet, but in my campaign, part of the central mythology of my campaign is that everything the players believe about the Dawn War is wrong. So they're rewriting their mythology as they go along and discover new things and discover what really happened at the dawn of time. So coming up with an alternate explanation for why the Underdark is there is probably in my best interest at some point.
Sure.
Well, that's very cool.
And as a sort of Forgotten Realms geek here, this concept of the Underdark does not play into the previous edition, at least Forgotten Realms concept of the Underdark, because so far as I know, Torog didn't exist, and doesn't exist in the fourth edition realms either.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
Which makes the book unusable.
Well, I don't know if it makes it unusable. I'm willing to take. I mean, first of all, if you've accepted and embraced wholeheartedly the fourth edition version of the realms, you're already willing to make some pretty drastic changes anyway to your game. So I'm sort of willing to say maybe there is an entity or some sort of creature. It doesn't have to be a god. Maybe some people think it's a god. Maybe it is a god, but is a long forgotten god that nobody sort of remembers because he stays down in the Underdark and never comes out. So I think there's ways to make it work. I think you can also use the vast majority of this book and draw inspiration from it even without saying that Torog is still around down there. Maybe there was once an entity that crashed around down there, created the Underdark, and is now gone. And you don't have to say that he's still down there anymore. So I think you can make it work. I just think it is going to require a little bit more work for somebody who doesn't want to accept the concept of this god with, you know, limp limbs dragging along behind him because he can't walk, creating a good chunk of the Underdark. So anyway,
I think playing him as having him as a primordial would actually work really easy, or just simply as, you know, some super powerful god or something. You could easily throw that into Forgotten Realms as just another belief on how the Underdark was created amongst all the other beliefs that exist in Forgotten Realms on how it was formed.
Absolutely. So yeah, I think it can be.
Or just blame the spellblade.
Yeah. Maybe it was a primordial.
Chalk it up to the spell plague.
Maybe it was a primordial from the other world who is now back, brought back by the spell plague.
Yeah.
That could work as well.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I think there's absolutely ways that you can make it work in not just the Forgotten Realms. We're focusing a lot on that because there's a lot of history between the Underdark and the Forgotten Realms. But I think you can legitimately make a lot of this book really cool and really work for you if you're willing to do that work. Because I think that's really my one big criticism of the book, is that it's really, more so than most of these kinds of books, it's really entrenched into buying into a few key parts of a setting story that may or may not apply to your setting. But I think you can do it.
Did I?
Go ahead.
Did I just miss it? Or I don't remember seeing any sort of even a sidebar, you know, about the Underdark in the realms or the Underdark in Eberron or the Underdark on Athas, for example. Was that in there and I missed it, or did you not see it either?
I don't remember seeing it.
It's not
no,
there.
But usually they cover that type of thing in D&D Insider. They did that with Keep on the Shadowfell and things like that. They added in on D&D Insider what you could expect, like, to do if you were playing in Forgotten Realms or Eberron.
Sure. Cool. Okay. So any other things we want to point out in the – I mean, we've harped a lot about one thing in the first chapter. Anything that in that first chapter that stands out as interesting that we should maybe talk about?
Well, you know, if you're looking to if you're looking to set an entire campaign from start to finish in the Underdark, you do have this feature that they've been putting into recent books where they make some suggestions about an entire arc that can carry you from low hero, you know, from the beginning to up all the way through your epic tier. So DMs who are looking for kind of a jump start will find those things pretty helpful.
Yeah, and I find
and
most of them
of course
really
it's not
cool.
More than six pages or so.
Yeah, I find most of those
if you don't need
really
it, you don't use
it. Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing, is that, you know, I've been in the middle of my campaign for 2 years now, whenever 4th edition came out, right? So all of these things I find interesting, and I really enjoy reading them as entertaining reading, but they're not always useful to me, right? Because I already have a story I'm telling, you know? But I still enjoy reading.
I'm a big fan of the I'm a big fan of the story arc, the Secret of the Wayfarers. I'm considering using that in our next campaign that I end up running once I move to Chicago. It's all about basically the players being children of an adventuring party, and they basically have to go up and clean up their parents' mess that they made years ago,
right.
And in the end take down Torog, who their parents battled before.
Yeah, yeah, I like that idea of you're sort of the legacy of a former adventuring party.
Yeah.
All right. So that covers Chapter 1 pretty well. And one of the things they mention in Chapter 1 that appears in the next four chapters that's worth talking a little bit about separately is this idea of the King's Highway. The story goes that Torog, this god, was in the Underdark way back during the Dawn War. Has a little tussle with a primordial who destroys the lower half of Torog's body. And then Torog manages to pull off the killing blow. But ever since then, Torog has been unable to leave the Underdark and is without the use of his lower extremities. And so he's constantly been crashing his way through walls and tunnels and slamming into this. And as he does so, he not only breaks through walls and creates these tunnels throughout the Underdark, which become the King's Highway, but he also crashes through the various planes. And so there's this sort of extra large tunnel that you can follow through the Underdark that crashes through, you know, not only from the shallows down into the deeps and then into the Feydark and into the Shadowdark and all over the place, as this guy extols his rage and tries to escape his prison in the Underdark. Does that cover what the King's Highway is?
Pretty much.
Yeah, and I really liked the way that it all worked. I like the fact that there's this sort of magical field around the King's Highway that everyone really feels as you move through it, and how it draws monsters to it. It makes it really convenient. If you want to throw a couple monsters at the players, you just say that the King's Highway drew them to it, and suddenly they're facing off a gang of Abelists or something.
Yeah.
Jeff, can I mention something here about the first chapter also that,
yeah,
that
go
slipped
ahead.
My mind? I really think the first chapter – one thing that's really great about this chapter is all the sidebars that are included in the chapter. I think they do a really good job of you know, walking you through more or less how to handle the Underdark. If it's, you know, if it's your first time in, or if you're a new DM, you know, coming into this Underdark for the first time, how to, you know, present it to your players, how to avoid doing certain things that maybe you don't want to focus on too much, like, you know, gathering food and water, for example. You know, no one needs to sit through 2 hours of that. You know, they have really good sidebars, and really in all the book, and the entire book has really good sidebars on how to use the Underdark and a sort of behind the scenes look at, you know, what things you should do, what things you shouldn't. And there's a lot of good tips and stuff like for DMs here with these sidebars. And there's a lot of sidebars in the book. It's really, I'm really looking at it now, and there's a lot of sidebars with a lot of good info here. And that's one of the things that I really like about the chapter.
Yeah, and I found it interesting. I think it was in that first chapter where they talked about using the Underdark in your campaign, and they actually sort of outright admit that, okay, you know what? If you've got lower level characters, maybe the Underdark is not the place that they should be calling home. You know, they say you could make little, you know, our advice is make forays into the Underdark, have a mission here or there or whatever, but don't just hang out in the Underdark because it's probably too deadly for a low level character in order to, you know, really be the Underdark. So as much as they're trying to make this a setting that's useful, they are admitting at the same time that, you know, some settings need to be dangerous when you're not so powerful, and maybe that's okay, and that maybe they could go there for a quick trip and then get out, and that's part of the joy of it, because then later on they're the big tough guys and can handle it.
Yeah, I sort of felt like there was a kind of a little bit, though, maybe of too much in some of the sideboards, too much protecting the PCs. And I don't know how you all feel about this. I'd like to hear, but there were several paragraphs in some of the sidebars which seemed to me to come off as now, don't do anything negative to the characters. Just make the environment around them be strange. Like the pervasive gloom sidebar on page 13. Don't apply negatives for emotional disturbances to the PCs. Just role play the NPCs like they're weird. And I that came off a little, I don't know, the wrong way to me. I that was one aspect of chapter one that I kind of objected to a little bit. I don't have a problem with making life hard. I think on the PCs, especially in a place that's supposed to be so bizarre and so challenging to them.
Yeah, and I think the trick is finding the balance of. You want to make it hard, but you don't want to make it annoying and into a bit of a grind for the players. You know, make it hard for the PCs, but don't drive the players crazy so they're not having fun anymore.
I mean, do you guys think that this is all part of that whole mentality of PCs being difficult to kill and you know they're here to have fun, so don't kill them off. 20 healing surges and I don't know. I think fourth edition is meant to not kill PCs anyways. And I think this just fits into that whole mentality.
I can see that.
Where they kind of expect you to take a character from first to 30th and never die, I think that's just part of the game.
I think there's definitely some of that to the game. There is an element of danger and it is possible for PCs to die. I've killed a couple in my campaign, but not as many as I would have in previous editions, and I don't think that's accidental.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that can definitely be a big issue. I don't think the only PC that I've ever killed off was my own DM PC that I was running at the time, and that was just to add a lot more, make the players feel like they were in a lot more danger. But I haven't ever come upon any player even being in any danger of dying. Which may be a problem on my part, but I'd like to start challenging the players more and having them have to watch their back a little bit.
We should switch every now and then. You can start designing encounters for me, and I'll do yours because my encounters my encounters tend to be too hard. They always escape by the skin of their teeth, and I've killed two or three PCs, but luckily they've all been from the same player.
Yeah.
So I've only killed PCs from one player, but I've killed him two or three times.
Who's that lucky four?
What's that?
I said, who's that lucky four that they've always been from the same player?
Oh, well, that's
lucky for you or lucky for the player?
Lucky for everybody else who's not that player.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's the player that I always seem to accidentally kill is actually another podcaster and a friend, Jeremiah McCoy, who lives in the area and plays in my game. So I know he can take it. In any case, we went on a bit of a sidebar and a tangent here ourselves when we talked about the sidebars. We were talking about the King's Highway, and there are some interesting things that come out of each chapter. A specific sort of terrain, I guess, or hazard that the King's Highway has depending on which section of the Underdark you're in. And I thought that was an interesting concept. The idea that, this god is oozing and bleeding and suffering all along this highway as he's crashing around under there. And that leaves some residual sort of divine or magical effects that can make an encounter more interesting. What did you guys think of the god's dream and god's rage and all those things?
I thought they were some pretty cool stuff, and I'd definitely end up implementing them in my games. I really like adding in environmental effects. I think they can add a lot of depth, and I've had my players use the terrain to their advantage, doing things that'll end up screwing over the monsters. So that's been pretty fun.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed them. And a lot of these, I think, are good inspiration, even if you don't use them in the Underdark or use the same story with Torog or whatever. Some of these could very easily be a magical field that the wizard has placed inside of his tower to give a boost to his minions who are protecting him or whatever. You know, I could see a lot of it working that way as well, and still being very cool and interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the God's Dream one, where if you spend a healing surge, you sort of you're taking minuses to your attack rolls, but you critical on a 17 to 20. So you sort of go into this sort of almost rage, you know. So you're not really as careful about your swings, but when you hit them, they're going to feel it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked that.
And I like that most of them are – it affects one creature. Like the magic of the terrain sort of seeps into one person until something triggers it, and then it leaves them. But then it's available to enter somebody else, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So any other thoughts on the King's Highway before we start looking at some of these different areas of the Underdark? All right.
No, I don't think so.
Let's get into it then. They've broken the Underdark up into four sections: the Shallows, the Deeps, the Fey Dark, and the Shatter Dark. The Shallows is in our normal world, but not as deep. The Deeps is obviously your deep, deep into the core of the earth sort of thing. And then the Fey Dark is the Feywild version of the Underdark, and Shatter Dark being the Shadowfell version of the Underdark. So the way we're going to do this is we're each going to find one thing from each chapter we want to talk about. Rather than going through every single location or hook or whatever, I think we should just pick out one thing that we're particularly interested in. So let people know what's in there, either something we like or something we don't like or something that we think people should know about, and then move through it that way so we can get on to the last chapter. So Shallows, who wants to go first? What do we like or not like or want to talk about?
I'll take it here.
Well, yeah.
Sorry. I'm a big fan of dwarves. You know, every time I play a dwarf. I've been playing the same dwarf for, you know, 20 years now. So I'm a big dwarf guy. And I really like the fact that they gave the dwarves, you know, a mining city down there in the Shallows, Forge Home. It's a it's a location for heroic tier characters. So even if you're starting out, you know, this could be your first point of entry into the Underdark. And it screams of, you know, here's a dwarf settlement. You could place this really anywhere you want. I mean, I don't know if you really need to keep it too, you know, tied into the Underdark. I mean, you could take a lot of these things and apply them to, you know, a dwarven city somewhere else, you know, in some mountain somewhere or whatever. And I think it does a really good job of capturing the flavor of dwarves. You know, you got the drinking halls, you got the miners, you got, you know, just it has a lot of flavor. Like everything else in this book, is I really think this book does a good job of capturing flavor. I think this part of the chapter was my favorite, the dwarven. And knowing what I know about what they're going to do with the dwarven city that's going to be released soon for 4E, I really like this in particular because it really screams of a real dwarven settlement more so than the other one that's coming out soon.
Well, it's funny because they sort of make insinuation that dwarves kind of shy away from and stay away from the Underdark, and but then of course they give you this city as an example of, well, but not always or not really, because and that makes sense to me. You know, dwarves are stalwart, and to heck if the Underdark's going to stop them from going where they want to go and mining what they want to mine. So I like the concept they have that in there as well.
Right.
What else, Chris? You go.
Well, I really like the way in which they give a backstory to various creatures and creature groups that that to me have for a while been just sort of there, with no real place in the world, I guess. I mean, I know that troglodytes are supposed to be in caverns and underground and stuff, but now with this chapter 2, I sort of have a better handle on how to think about how are troglodytes and quaggoths and grells even fit, you know, into a story world. And what, you know, and then I can decide whether or not I want to use those story elements. But they're not just these sort of random monsters running around somewhere. So the way in which this chapter lays out some things about the different social groupings and the interactions between troglodytes and dwarves, troglodytes and grells, and even those crazy aboleths from the deeps. I really appreciated that. The sort of thing that sparks my imagination and gets me thinking about ways to incorporate those creatures into different encounters, you know, and how to tell some of those stories in my own campaign. And by the way, I do agree very much with Enrique about liking this whole idea of Forge Home and the write-up on Forge Home in this chapter, and probably will use something very, very similar to that in the campaign coming up pretty soon as the PC's first introduction into this vast underground world.
Cool. And Mark, what do you got for us? What do you like or want to talk about in this book or in this chapter?
I really liked Mailbrothier. Is that how you pronounce that?
I'll give it to you. It is now.
It is now.
It's a yeah, there you go. It's official. It's a book that was – or it's a city that was sort of pulled into the Underdark by Torag a long time ago. And so you have – from the picture that's really cool, you've got all these – human-looking buildings that are all on different tiers of land that have been sort of pulled down, and some of them look like they're sagging in the middle and things like that. And now it's just sort of become sort of a melting pot. And I just really liked the whole idea of that human city that just vanished below the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to point out, I really like the art for all the locations that they have throughout the entire book. They're all dark and gloomy and are really evocative.
Yeah, I found the art in general,
yes,
through the book, as a side note, to get it out of the way now, I found the art in general to be some of the best and most evocative art, like you just described, in a lot of books that I've seen lately.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's my turn then. Go ahead.
Sorry, can I break in with something here, Jeff? I don't know if we said this explicitly before, but it may be worth pointing out, you know, that one of the features of all of these chapters is a series of locations.
Mm-hmm.
For people who haven't seen the book, you know, so we have this dwarven forge home, and we have this Mailbrothier, and several other locations in each of these chapters. So for the shallows and the deeps and so on. Which from which DMs can really pick and choose where they want to guide the players or guide the PCs. And some of these are fleshed out in quite a little bit of detail. I mean, Mailbrothier's got several mm-hmm. pages describing the society and major NPCs and mm-hmm. Some of the intrigue going on within the city. So these give – there's really a lot of stuff you can mine out of these for your campaign.
Absolutely. And in fact, it is worth noting, and thank you for sharing, most of these chapters is descriptions of different locations. You know, you usually get a chapter or two talking – or a page or two talking about, you know, the kinds of creatures you might run into and what are visitors doing there and that kind of thing. But you're right. Most of each of these chapters is detailing different places that you might go and how to incorporate them in and what they're like and who's there and all that kind of stuff. You do occasionally also get sample encounters that you might be able to throw into your game. In a few pages,
which
here,
by the way, I was
yeah. Go on.
Okay, I was really excited about seeing all these different encounters because every single one of them uses dungeon tile sets that I own. So unlike the Dungeon Delve set, which the Dungeon Delve book. It has all kinds of different dungeon tiles such that I don't have. With this, I can use pretty much any of them.
Cool.
Yeah, and I would assume that we could expect to see these tiles among those in the master sets coming out later in the year.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, it's possible. Yeah, my secret wish, if I were in charge of D&D Insider and all the things going on over there, is that they would collect all these encounters into a searchable database for D&D Insider subscribers. So, you know, okay, I need an encounter in the Underdark level 13, and they'll pull up whatever's been published, you know, and make it useful in that way. You know, that, I think that would be really cool. Otherwise, these are neat in terms of looking through them as examples and coming up with ideas of how to build my encounters. But I'm probably not going to pull them out and actually use them, you know, as they're written for any game that I'm going to run. And, you know, unless it was searchable and easy to find no matter what book it was in. But I do find them to be decent sources of inspiration for building encounters.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I should talk about my pick for this chapter is the Dark Lake Ziggurat. And there's one element of it that I like particularly, and it kind of reminds me of some of the things I used to see a lot back in my second edition days, where there were a lot of randomness going on, you know? The idea of rolling a d4 and figuring out, okay, you went into this room, roll a d4. In this room now, everybody's going to take a +2 bonus to damage rolls and a -2 to AC because everybody's filled with the savage fury in this, you know, because of the reality warping nature of this location. I like the idea of when you get to the portal, the Nexus of Realms, if you touch it, it sucks you in and you might disappear for up to a month before you pop back out.
Yeah.
Having been to another plane, you pop suddenly back out 1 month later, all confused and discombobulated. You know, hopefully you're luckier and you come out 1 round or 1 minute later or whatever. But, you know, that sense of randomness is one of the fun elements that they used to use a lot in older editions that every now and then, I don't want to do it all the time, but every now and then I think it's a lot of fun to throw those kinds of things in.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Then let's get into chapter 3, The Deeps. We'll
deeps.
Work from another direction here.
Go ahead. Or where we hit the drow.
Where we hit the drow.
Yeah.
Well, and this is historically, I mean, I guess my experience goes back to Underdark books and descriptions from Forgotten Realms products. And in the Forgotten Realms, in third edition, the Underdark book sort of described 3 levels of the Underdark instead of 2. So there was what is now the shallows, and then there's sort of this middle dark, which is where the drow were, and then the deeper dark, which is where you would have found, you know, your beholders and aboleths and that kind of stuff. So the really scary stuff was way down there. The scary stuff that you've heard of, like the drow, are in the middle, and then, you know, your troglodytes and everything else is right up towards the top.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mark, why don't you start us off? Tell us one thing that you want to talk about in this chapter.
I loved the Sunless Seas. The art in it was really, really nice. And just the idea that there's just these endless seas underneath the earth, where when you look up, you don't see sky, you just see stone up in the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
I thought was really, really cool. I could definitely see running some adventures on that. And then, you know, even having some Underdark pirates out on those seas and stuff. I think it'd be really awesome. They have a whole thing on ghost ships, which I thought was awesome.
Well, and how they pull the ghost ships from the surface world. They, you know, a big storm hits the surface world and it pulls them down into the Underdark version of the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. Chris, you're next.
Well, Mark already stole the Sunless Seas. My current campaign is a seagoing campaign, and so I really like that. But, you know, it's got to be Mind Flayers, right? I mean, I got a soft spot in my heart for Mind Flayers. So I was actually a little disappointed that they only got, like, 2.5 pages down here in the deeps. But pretty excited to see that stuff. Give me some ideas for how I might challenge my players with Illithids.
Well, and that was going to be my pick as well, as the description of, is it Nihiloth? In the section called the Past Masters, dealing with the ancient empire of the Mind Flayers and how they got there and who they are and you know, the Ur-Brain, the original Elder Brain, and that whole mythology, I think, is really cool and something that we didn't necessarily have in detail before that I really enjoyed. I agree. That was my pick as well, so I'm going to piggyback with you on that one. So, Enrique, do you have something different
for us? And what's up with that?
Oh, go ahead.
What's up with that picture that's in that Past Masters section? Is that like the entrance to Nihilath that looks awesome with all the teeth and
I think they're trying to describe.
Yes, on page 83.
On the description for the section there that says aberrant structures, they talk about how they actually pull living tissue from through the far realm to create their buildings and things.
That's horrifying.
And so, yeah, I get the impression that that's actually, you know, an illithid tower or what have you. And there's actually environmental effects of even being near it. That it just sort of messes with you because it's so twisted and not of this world.
Yeah.
Now, this might be a good place to jump in with a little question for the rest of you. I always appreciate these knowledge check sidebars and paragraphs that they have, but I'm not sure that I'm necessarily going to use them once my PCs actually go into the Underdark, because it's something that's so far outside their experience that maybe they don't even have access to any of that knowledge.
Yeah, I sort of play a lot of those things.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I kind of play a lot of those things by ear, right? You know, depending on who my players are and what the campaign is and that kind of stuff, I might give them a knowledge check, but the information they get from that knowledge check is completely determined by me, not usually by what I pull out of a book. I like those things because, you know, if I want, you know, okay, I've read this book and I'm getting ready to do a review of it like I am tonight, right? I might go back and just read through the knowledge check section to give me sort of a reminder of, oh yeah, that's what that section was about, you know? It's a good way to sort of brush up on what that, you know, summarize what's going on in that place or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that Chris's line of thinking also applies to a lot of other things besides the Underdark. I think, you know, if your PCs are facing a beholder for the first time and, you know, one guy makes a knowledge check and he gets a lucky roll and he rolls a 30 or whatever, you know, I don't know. Maybe his character doesn't have the experience to really know the amount of information a 30 check would give him. You know what I mean? So I sort of play those things by ear as a DM. I don't stick to the book and I don't stick to the rules too much when it comes to that stuff, because you got to also have a sense of, you know, realism here. I mean, your guy has never seen a beholder. He doesn't know what the heck a beholder is. Just because you rolled a lucky roll doesn't mean that you suddenly are awash with information on beholders. It doesn't work that.
I sort of go both ways on that too. Because at the same time, you can pretty easily justify that. Oh, this is a beholder. I've never seen one before, but I heard stories about one. You know, because we're adventurers that move around. We've been talking to people and telling stories, and so we've got a little more experience. I'm willing to give the players a win on some of those things every now and then when they get the lucky rolls. But you're right. There's some instances where I don't – you know, I might be lenient with that information on creatures sometimes, but with locations or backstory or that kind of stuff, I would almost rather reveal that through – storytelling than, okay, I guess you made a roll, so you know that the secret master of this place is whoever, you know?
Yeah,
right.
So, Enrique, since you were just talking, and you're the last one here, was there a section in this book that you wanted to mention as well?
Well, yeah, my favorite section I'm going to share with Mark was the Sun to Sea section, but I also really like the Buzzing Vault. And that's because I can already picture it in my mind, you know, the characters walking into this giant cave and these guys buzzing around and you can hear buzzing in every direction. And it just makes for like a really cool and cinematic scene to play out. You know, you got these guys flapping around like hummingbirds, you know, buzzing around like insects. It looks, just the picture looks really cool, and the image I get with the noise and the audio effect that I can imagine makes for a really cool setting, I think.
Yeah.
With these new creatures called sword wings, which I haven't really studied their stat block too much, but it seems like a cool area to adventure in.
They're new-ish. They're brought in from third.
Oh, okay. See, I didn't know that. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. I mean, they weren't real predominant in many locations, but they did sort of make an appearance in third. And now have been brought back in. Yeah, and there's other cool stuff in there too. I also really liked the section on beholders and sort of giving the story of how beholders came about. I know a lot of people have said they really like this book because it acknowledges the drow but doesn't necessarily focus on them. And this is the section where you get to learn a little bit about the drow. And in fairness, it seems to me that the section on the drow city is the most extensive section in the deeps. You know, it gets several good-sized pages dedicated to it, but you also get a lot of other stuff mixed in there as well.
And I think we should also say, you know, it's not just that, oh, they're drow, so they get more pages, but the drow city is probably the one place that in the deeps that might serve as a kind of home base, you know, if the PCs kind of work things right. That might be some place they could return to, you know, to hide away from the beholders for a while. Whereas, you know, the beholder colonies and things like that are not going to serve that function.
Right.
Earlier in the, looks like on, what page was that? Page 22, they mention doing a whole campaign arc where you become drow, where you maintain all, you keep all your statistics, but you get the Lolth touch trait, and then you you also look like a drow. Maybe you could allow the players to use that as their home base if they had medallions that did basically the same thing that they could put on to make themselves look like drow. You could do something like that so that least they had somewhere they were able to call home.
And that campaign arc actually involves, as I recall, infiltrating that very described city. So they're giving you setting because they've also given you story ideas on how to use that setting. All right, so let's move into chapter 4, which is our Feydark. What does the Underdark look like in the Feywild? And I'm going to start off this time around because I haven't done that yet. My favorite section in this is the one dealing with the gnomes. It seems to me they've really made gnomes from your cute and cuddly PCs into these really twisted survivalists, you know?
Yeah.
The opening description of the gnome realms talks about how, you know, in the Feydark, gnomes are marked by grim determination to survive, that they survive by living in the shadows of larger, fiercer kingdoms, but keeping themselves secret. I just really like this concept of these almost Machiavellian sort of gnomes that, you know, I may be small, but I'm doing what I got to do to survive, and if that means cutting your throat, then fine.
Yeah.
So, Chris...
I mean, gone are the days of the noble-built machines, huh?
Say that again, Enrique?
Yeah.
I said the gone are the days of the gnomes who built, you know, machines and were engineers.
Yeah.
Absolutely. These guys are twisted... Right. You know, these guys are twisted versions of what gnomes ever were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what they've done in 4E with the gnomes is, I guess, you know, they're trying to upset somebody who likes gnomes.
I guess, yeah.
Right.
Enrique, while you're talking, why don't you give us your favorite part of the Feydark?
Well, you took it from me. You took the gnome realms. I really think that they took bland, you know, little bland guys and they turned them into something worth exploring. These are gnomes that, you know, they go in berserker furies, you know, their eyes glaze over with red fury and they become killers and that's always fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I, in general, if you allow me to say something about the whole Feydark thing, I'm really kind of surprised that it even made it on the book. And again, it leads me to say, where is my Feywild hard book, you know, my hardcover exploring the entire Feywild.
Sure.
I thought this would have been something that would have been part of a Feywild book instead of a book on the Underdark, along with the other chapter that we'll talk about later, the Shadowdark. I don't know how I feel about the Underdark in the Feywild, to be honest with you. They had to do something to make it different, so they made it a little more luminescent and more plant life and more alive than the Underdark, I guess. But, I don't know. It's sort of a meh feeling to it. I don't know how I feel about it. And I don't know if I'll ever even introduce it in my game, to be honest with you. I'm sort of indifferent towards it. I mean, it has to exist because the Feywild needs to have an underground to it. And I guess this is it. You know, it's kind of an Underdark with plants in it.
Yeah.
And gnomes.
And it sort of works. And it seems like maybe they even took a similar stance in that, because, I mean, the two smallest sections, and it seems to me, I haven't counted the pages, but it seems to me the smallest section of the whole book is the Faedark. You know, they don't spend as much time dealing with that as they do with other things.
They don't.
So, Mark, what's your pick?
I liked the Living Grotto with the Myconids. Mm-hmm. The little the mushroom men. I know a lot of people have sort of bashed the Myconids and thought they were ridiculous, but I like the idea of just these strange little alien beings that are made out of mushrooms, and their cities are mushrooms, and they feel very, very alien to me. And I would definitely play that up in any game that I was running. So I thought that was pretty cool. I like the Spore Lord that they refer to. They don't exactly say how he looks, but based on his name, the Spore Lord, I imagine you could probably definitely come up with something bizarre and grotesque.
Yeah, I've got all kinds of images and ideas and monster creation that would go along with the Spore Lord.
Exactly, yeah.
All right.
There could be some pretty cool rechargeable powers with that.
Yeah. All right, Chris, what do you got for us?
Well, I think for this part, for the Faedark, I think I'm going to have to say what I wish had been there that I didn't find.
I think that's fair.
And I tell you what I really wanted from this chapter that I didn't get was more about Cyclopses. The 4E impulse to try to bring back Cyclopses and make them a big deal, and give you 19 different types of Cyclopses in the various monster manuals and so forth. It was one of the things that sort of was an interesting new flavor, kind of bringing back some old creatures into 4E that were kind of sat out from 3E. But even though they're introduced at the beginning as these servitors to the Fomorians, neither the Fomorians nor the Cyclopses really get a lot of attention in this particular chapter.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that may relate to what Enrique was saying. I mean, I think there has become this pattern in some of these books that you plant a seed, or maybe you send out spores, so to speak, and they don't blossom until a later book. So we got the Manual of the Planes, which sort of introduced the elemental chaos and introduced the elemental, the astral sea. And then you get a book about each one, and Enrique's looking for his Feywild book, and assume there'll someday be a Shadowfell book. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if those things will get developed more in those books as well, which is a double-edged sword, I think. I mean, I think they probably could have played up some other parts of the Underdark more and left the Faedark and the Shadowdark for another time, but that's sort of neither here nor there.
Okay, very good. I think those are fair comments and interesting food for thought.
Well, and y'all already sold my mushrooms, so there you go.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. We'll move on to the Shadowdark chapter, chapter 5, and we'll give you first shot at it. So, Chris, what's your pick for Shadowdark?
Oh, good.
Yeah, caught you unaware, didn't it?
The Shadowdark. Yes, indeed. Indeed.
The Shadow what?
Yeah, I just don't know what to pick for the Shadowdark. I'm really intrigued by these Incunabula. Mm-hmm. This new race, I mean, Darth Maul and all his kin, quite frankly, with their little horns on their heads. Uh-huh. But I really haven't sat back and sort of thought about it enough to figure out how they fit into my world and whether or not I want them to be a part of my Shadowdark.
Yeah, I kind of like the concept of them. They need an alternative name that's easier to pronounce. You know, they almost feel like they feel to me for fourth edition a little bit like the Shadar Kai felt for me in third edition. You know, third edition, the drow were the mainstream, for if you wanted the dark, tortured character. And the Shatter Kai were for, you know, I really like Shatter Kai as not mainstream, but still able to sort of build that concept. And these monsters sort of feel like they have that corner for 4th edition, now that Shatter Kai are more and more commonplace, right? Mm-hmm. We've got PC races for them and all that kind of stuff. These things feel like they would fit that role pretty well. They've got an interesting society dealing with the wrappings, the clothing and that kind of stuff that they wear being passed down from generation to generation, so you can identify them and what family they're from and all that kind of stuff. And I really like that, because this is my – this talking about this was going to be my pick as well. I really like that they give you a monster theme from that we got originally from the DMG2. I really like this concept of monster themes where, okay, I can make a creature and just apply this theme, and now it feels like it belongs, you know, with this set of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of the themes. I think they're awesome.
Yeah. I need to get in practice and start building some more themes myself. It's my goal for the next few weeks.
Well, and I think it's somewhat interesting to have this race, which is all about collecting knowledge, down here in the middle of the Underdark, which is so chaotic and unpredictable and in some ways virtually unknowable.
But
ever changing.
That's part of what I think is cool about them, because they're about collecting knowledge, but they're also followers of Vecna, who's about knowledge, but secrets, you know? So they're collecting knowledge, and being in the Underdark is the perfect place to hide them.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. So that's me and Chris. Who wants to go next?
And I'm going to butcher this name here. The race we're talking about, the Incunabula? Uh-huh. Incunabula? I think that's pretty much the only interesting thing in this chapter, to be honest with you. Glimmer, the City of Secrets, where they're from, and them as a race, and the fact that, you know, the knowledge-seeking, like you guys were talking about. I think really that's the only interesting thing in this chapter. There's really nothing, like I said before, there's really nothing in these two chapters that really wows me too much. And it sort of feels tacked on a bit, you know.
Sure.
The Underdarks for the two mirror dimensions. Uh-huh. I don't know. There's nothing in the description of the Shadow Dark, for example. It's just a very cold, gloomy, black, you know, freezing place. I don't know. That to me sounds like it could be the bottom of the Underdark, you know. I don't know if it necessarily has to be the under the Shadow Dark, you know what I mean? Under the Shadowfell, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I would just combine these locations right into the Underdark itself.
Well, and that's what they kind of do.
It doesn't feel too unique.
With the King's Highway, they sort of do combine all these things, right? Because you can be wandering down the King's Highway and just accidentally wander into the Fey Dark or the Shadow Dark or whatever.
And you'd never know.
And you would never know. Yeah. So I think...
So it just doesn't feel, like, to me, very unique.
I almost wonder if the whole point is that since you could just wander in, then this is an excuse that you as a DM can say, I want to take these elements that I like of the Shadow Dark or the Fey Dark and just stick them into my Underdark campaign, and I can do that because they just wandered in there and never knew, and then they wandered out and never knew, you know? And so there's some cohesiveness to the story of I can do whatever I want in the Underdark with these things, and it still makes sense. If they dig a little deeper,
yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
That sounds pretty good.
Or at least as believable as we're going to get with that. Let's get into the monster section. We're going a little long here, which I always do. I just can't help it. It's too much fun chatting about these things. but let's get into the monsters. We got lots of new monsters here. Although it's not full of new monsters. You get a few sort of staples, a few more varieties of monsters that we've already had. You get some new things like the blood ooze, which is kind of nasty. But you also just get more varieties of gnomes and you know, that kind of thing as well. So what stands out to us as monsters that we want to talk about?
I think we'd all be remiss if we don't talk about those.
We'd all be remiss if we didn't talk about what, Enrique?
The single most craziest image in a D&D book to date, which would be on page 157, the image of Torog, the king that crawls.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah, definitely.
We're talking about, you know, torture porn, makes his debut in D&D.
Yeah.
You know.
It is, I think, by far the most gory image I've seen in a D&D book in my history of playing D&D.
Yes.
It is really, really terrifying.
Yeah. I found it interesting.
Which is funny.
Go ahead.
Because I think in Thunderspire Labyrinth, you end up running into some Durgar who worship Torog, and I believe his statue that they have is a frog. I may be completely misremembering it, but I remember my players went in there, and I believe the statue is a frog, and so I was expecting something quite a bit different.
Froghemoth!
Than this guy. Yeah.
Okay, well, interesting.
Who wants to take a shot at describing him to the listeners? Because this is really, if you haven't seen it, I mean, the guy from Goonies, the bald guy from Goonies, I don't remember his name. That crazy dude.
Sloth.
Kind of him with leprosy. Yeah, Sloth with leprosy. Uh-huh. And knives sticking out of his back and bones coming out of his feet. I don't know. It's very bizarre.
And chains hanging off him. I mean, you can see his toes are broken and the flesh is torn off of his heel so that the heel bone is actually poking out through the skin. And there's, of course, gore,
right.
A trail of gore behind him as he's dragging himself along the ground.
And he's got these metal spikes. I mean, had daggers and swords. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty gross.
It's really, yeah.
That's pretty bizarre.
All right, so let's move on to more pleasant things. I found it interesting, if you can in the Underdark, I found it interesting that this gives me a chance to talk a little bit about the element with they put in with the drow, with the elemental eye, which is a throwback to the, Temple of Elemental Evil. Old classic sort of adventure that dealt with Thar's Dun and the elemental, the elder elemental eye and all this kind of stuff, right? And so I found it interesting that you don't get any new stats for drow in this book, except you get a couple of elemental eye cultists and priests and that kind of thing, which in the storyline of this book are also drow.
Right.
Yeah.
Was there anything
which I think is fine. I think it was a good choice not to give a lot of extra drow, in part because you have drow as a PC race.
Sure.
So you can easily create your NPCs that way. But I think fleshing out okay, now I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth, I guess, because I think fleshing out the gnomes and the grimlocks and you know, obviously Incunabula, you know, and kind of giving some variety to those races was probably a good choice, and maybe even a good choice to do that rather than pile in a bunch of extra monsters that are just sort of random one-off kinds of creatures, kind of what the 3.5 Monster Manual series got into, you know, all these crazy creatures that didn't seem to fit into the ecology anywhere. So I really like that. I would really have liked to have seen as some sort of martial melee combat mind flayer. Although I'm happy to have a convenient write up for a mind flayer artillery. That's very good.
Yeah, I like the mind flayer add addition. I agree. I sort of wish there was more. The what I think are the more glaring omissions are the races that they actually spend quite a bit of time talking about that we don't get more of. You know, I would have liked to have seen another beholder type or two. I would have liked to have seen a couple more aboleths. Or troglodytes,
sure.
Or you know these things that they talk about at length, but we don't see any of. And mind flayers as well. We get one more mind flayer, but I would have liked to have seen more.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Although I really do like the way they've tried to make my conids interesting and scary. As hard as it might be to make a mushroom man scary.
You know what else?
Like
is
those.
Good,
I also like the Kuotoa.
The Kuotoa.
Yeah, I've been a big fan.
Yeah, well, don't
of
tell my PCs.
One of my buddies hates
they,
the Kuotoa.
They can expect
your PCs are going to expect Kuotoa soon.
Yeah, don't tell my players, but they can expect to see lots of Kuotoa when they go underground. Yeah.
So, Enrique, you were going to say something.
Yeah, Chris brought up the Myconids, mm-hmm. and I think it's worth noting that you could take a party of heroic tier characters right into the Underdark, and you could use this book. You know, as a DM, you have a party of fourth level characters or fifth level characters. It doesn't matter. You have monsters here that you could create a delve or an adventure that takes them into the shadows of the Underdark, and they can fight Myconids and Dark Creepers and Troglodytes at heroic tier. So you don't really need to wait until your party's, you know, in the Paragon or epic tier to go into the Underdark. There's usable stuff here for all levels, which I think is a plus.
Yeah.
Good.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've talked through all the chapters. We've picked out the things that we liked and didn't like and what have you in the book. I think we've done a good, thorough job of looking at what this is about. I mentioned at the beginning that it seems like the goal of the book is to make the Underdark a good playable setting for your D&D game. So I wanted to ask one last question. Based off of what we've discussed, does it do that? Does it make the Underdark a good playable setting for your game? Mark, start us off.
I definitely think so. I could imagine running an entire campaign in the Underdark, never really addressing what's even on the surface world. If you started off in the Dwarven City that they feature in the book and then just continuing on from there, I think it's very well fleshed out, and I love all the locations in it.
Okay. Enrique.
I said it in my review, and I'll say it here again. I think this is a fantastic book for locations and campaigns and for DMs looking for something different to do with their party. I think it gives you enough to run, like Mark just said, it gives you enough to run a full campaign without ever needing to leave the Underdark. I mean, you could take a party from heroic tier all the way to epic. It's got enough hooks and stories and campaign arcs to last you not just one, but maybe two or three different campaigns if you wanted to do that.
Okay.
So, yes, it's a good book.
And Chris?
Yes, I think it absolutely does meet that goal. And in my own campaign, there are basically seven MacGuffins spread across the world. One of those MacGuffins is down deep, deep, deep in the Underdark. And this book is going to be my new best friend when the PCs head that direction.
Good. And my take is I think it's a pretty decent book. It has really good fluff, which is good for some inspiration, but not necessarily going to be the most useful to me, since it doesn't fit into my setting necessarily perfectly well. But where it does a really good job is I like a lot of the mechanical crunches. The bits of terrain that they give you, the diseases and the monsters in the back, I think those parts are really good, which is ironic because they're clearly not the focus of this book. Most of this book is dealing with the fluff and description of it, and I think that's fine, and it's well written, and it's interesting, but maybe a little bit less useful for my game personally. So I think we've got a more or less consensus here that it's a pretty good book. It's well written, it's interesting, and it provides a lot of inspiration for putting your game into the Underdark. Does that cover it?
I agree.
All right.
Yeah, I think so.
Yep.
Then this has been episode 127 of The Tome Show. I want to thank our sponsor, NobleKnight.com, for their support in this episode, and I also want to thank our guests. Mark, where can people find out more about you, and what have you been doing there lately?
They can find more about me at dicemonkey.net and also rpgcircus.com. RPG Circus is a podcast that I'm a part of with two other guys, Jeff and Zach, and Dice Monkey is my blog. And lately I've been talking a lot about different things that DMs and players can interact on. And also I've been talking about Mouse Guard a lot. I'm about to start a campaign with that, so I've been talking about that a lot.
And when he says that you're on that show with Jeff, it's not me, it's another Jeff. I know. It's scary.
No, it's another Jeff. It is
scary.
Another Jeff.
There's more than one of us out there, but it's a good show. And
yeah,
I've
it's Jeff
Furtado
from yeah, thanks. He's from the Bone Scroll, mm-hmm. and then Zach is from RPG Blog 2.
Good. And Chris, what are you up to these days? How's the podcast going? Have you caught up with real life yet?
Well, no, not yet. this campaign that I keep talking about is recorded and podcasted as an actual play podcast called Icosahedrophilia. And that's impossible to spell, but it's at d20.herdworld.com. And herd is spelled H-E-A-R-D. So d20.herdworld.com for all the links and show notes and things about our actual play podcast. Right now we're about 5 sessions behind real life in catching the podcast up to where we actually are. So we've had some character deaths, players moving away and new players coming in and all sorts of exciting stuff lately.
I've really enjoyed the recent series Microcosm. The setting for that was really evocative for me, and I enjoyed hearing all that.
Well, thank you very much.
And then we've also got Enrique. So tell us what's been going on over at newbiedm.com.
newbiedm.com. Well, what I hope to do with the website is to create a place for new DMs to go, and it's kind of like a one-stop shop to find, you know, tutorials and how to make maps and tokens for your game if you don't have any minis, or tips. You know, chances are if you have a question on DMing, I've probably had to answer it for my own game at some point. So it's kind of like a place for new DMs to come and sort of get the hang of DMing. I mean, I am a newbie DM. That's what the site is named for. It's not because anything else. I started DMing with 4th edition, so I go through the same issues that new DMs go through when I first started. And I hope to turn the site into a one-stop shop for new DMs to come and pick up tips and tricks and ideas and advice on how to better run their games. And right now I have I'm trying to start a Dungeon Delve archive. I just recently blogged about it, where I'm asking people to submit their homebrew delves and create a place for DMs to come in and look for a delve to download, and if they don't have anything prepped for the night, they can just come to my site, find a delve that's appropriate for the level they want to run, and get to playing. So that's really what I'm focusing on right now with the site.
Sort of like that searchable database of encounters that I want WotC put together.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Cool.
We'll see where it goes.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all of them. And you can always email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. As far as what I've been up to, I've been recording this episode right here that you're listening to. So that's me. of course, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for everything mentioned on the show, including all these gentlemen's websites, will be available in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 127, a journey into the darkness created by the crashing and ramblings of a physically handicapped god who would probably greatly benefit from the divine intervention or invention of a wheelchair to get around the Underdark, which is also the title of the book that we've discussed in this episode of
I'm on the wall.